My guest Joshua Ferris has written a satirical novel about office life in an advertising agency during the end of the dot-com boom and the beginning of the bust. It's called Then We Came to the End. In a front-page review in the New York Times Book Review, James Poniewozik described Ferris as fluent in the language of white-collar wordsmiths under siege and having a sixth sense for paranoia. Poniewozik described the novel as expansive, great-hearted, and acidly funny. Then We Came to the End is Ferris's first novel. Let's start with a short reading from the opening of the book.
We were fractious and overpaid. Our mornings lacked promise. At least those of us who smoked had something to look forward to at 10:15. Most of us liked most everyone. A few of us hated specific individuals. One or two people loved everyone and everything. Those who loved everyone were unanimously reviled. We loved free bagels in the morning. They happened all too infrequently. Our benefits were astonishing in comprehensiveness and quality of care. Sometimes we questioned whether they were worth it. We thought moving to India might be better, or going back to nursing school, doing something with the handicapped, or working with our hands. No one ever acted on these impulses, despite their daily, sometimes hourly contractions. Instead, we met in conference rooms to discuss the issues of the day.
That's Joshua Ferris reading the opening from his new book, Then We Came to the End. Joshua, welcome to Fresh Air. When I first heard about your book, I figured, this will be a not quite as funny version of The Office, which I love. But that's really not the direction you're heading in. Why did you want to write a novel set in an office?
Well, it's hard not to love The Office, and I started this book before The Office came out. The real reason that I wanted to write it was because when I first walked into my first office as, you know, a 24, 25-year-old guy, I was blown away by this behemoth structure. I mean, not just physically, the building itself and all of the cubes and offices, but also psychologically, where you had, you know, closed doors and protocols, secret protocols, conversations that you were picking up bits and pieces of, and strange euphemisms. And it just seemed like it was very good material for a sustained literary effort.
Now, the characters in your novel have a very ambivalent relation to the office they work in. You write, how we hated our coffee mugs, our mouse pads, our desk clocks, our daily calendars, the contents of our desk drawers, even the photos of our loved ones taped to our computer monitors for uplift and support turned into cloying reminders of time served. So on the one hand, these people feel really imprisoned by the office, but at the same time, it's kind of their social network.
That's right. The important part of that passage you just read comes directly afterwards when they talk about...
That's why I left it out.
did you leave it out for that specific reason? When they find out that they're moving into a new office, all of that boring, dull stuff that they encounter every day, you know, the photographs taped to the monitor and their coffee cups and so forth, sort of brighten in this new, improved space. And so this relationship that they have to their work and to the office that they come in, day out, it is ambiguous. You know, it is ambivalent, rather. And it was that was important for me to try to capture, because I think that it's not simply... Work is not simply dull, dull, dull. It also provides an astonishing amount of community and a good deal of one's self-identity, particularly with respect to the work people do.
Now, you were in advertising. Did you write advertising campaigns like the characters in your novel do?
Yeah, I was a copywriter, so I gave my hand to quite a few of them. I was never a particularly good copywriter, though, I don't think.
So one of the difficult to fulfill campaigns in your novel is that a client wants an ad campaign for cold sore medication, and they want it to be funny, but at the same time, they don't want people with cold sores to be offended by the campaign.
Right.
So were there campaigns like that that were really difficult to meet that you worked on?
There were, but they were far more dull, unfortunately. They were more like, you know, can we get this guy to move up his anytime minutes in a bill insert from Sprint or something like that? It wasn't quite as interesting and creative. The work that I did personally wasn't as interesting and creative as how can we make a cold sore sufferer into a hero of sorts.
So you wrote those inserts in the bills that we all get that we throw out without
yes.
bothering to read them.
Yes, I have contributed to your daily dose of annoyance.
Now, one of the complications in your novel is that a partner in the agency is dying of breast cancer. At least that's the rumor. And nobody's really sure or not whether she has breast cancer or she's been diagnosed yet or she's about to be diagnosed or whether she's really sick. But these kinds of projections and rumors and stuff in an office can be pretty absorbing. And I wonder why this aspect of the book, this kind of imagining what's really going on with the partner in the agency, is so important to you as a writer.
You know, the book is told from the group's point of view. And the group is sort of woefully out of touch in certain respects. They get other things exactly right, but because all of the information is being distilled through individuals into this, you know, group of people who might or might not really know the exact score on things, information is not terribly reliable. And I find that that is the case at work. And rumoring itself is sort of a group, very much a group dynamic. And so because it's filtered through so many people and it becomes kind of the group's voice spreading the rumors, it's tough to know what is true and what isn't. In particular here, with respect to Lynn Mason, the character who might or might not have breast cancer, there is something that goes beyond sort of the more craven rumor-mongering that takes place about maybe, you know, somebody's crush on somebody else, or if someone's an alcoholic. Here we're dealing with something that has far more lasting consequences. Is she sick? Is she dying? And that was interesting to me because in some respects, death really is sort of the last taboo that advertising can speak about. Advertising talks in a thousand different ways about sex, and it talks in a thousand different ways about anything, really. Anything is up for grabs in advertising, anything that will sell. But you don't see too many funeral parlors advertising, and you don't see too many Volkswagens being sold on the premise of death. And so breast cancer and advertising don't make very friendly bedfellows. And I was very interested in exploring the limits that advertising has in terms of speaking about that.
My guest is Joshua Ferris, and his new novel is called Then We Came to the End, and it's a novel set in an advertising agency, basically about office life. How long did you work in offices before leaving that life for full-time writing?
I worked in offices for about 4 years, I'd say. It might have been only 3.5, but let's say 4. And before I worked in advertising, I had many work experiences. I started working actually when I was very young and living in Key West, and I worked in restaurants. And I met a terrific cast of people who, you know, came and went. And then I worked through high school too. So while I wasn't working in an office with the cubicles and the offices and the hierarchies and so forth, I certainly worked for many, many years and have known that work dynamic that grows up amongst people for a long time.
In your novel, you write, we had these sudden revelations that the daily 9-to-5 was driving us far from our better selves. Did you feel that way when you were working in the advertising agencies? And then when you left, did you become the better person that you felt like your job was holding you back from becoming?
I suspect that I had good days and bad days then, and I have good days and bad days now. That it's no different. I think that what happens is that it becomes so highlighted because you can't get away from the other person's gaze. I mean, sometimes you can certain offices you can close the door and or maybe you have an hour out on the street or eating lunch or something. But you're always sort of under a big brother condition where somebody's always watching. Somebody's always talking. You're always getting roped into conversations and you're saying things that suddenly either in agreement with the group or you know, against the group, and they all look at you like you're an alien. And it's that sort of pressure cooker condition that makes that made me anyway feel as if I all of my flaws are really being highlighted, and if I could just get out and sort of be at home, then I'd be a better person. Likely, it's probably that, you know, I'm just not being seen when I'm being at my worst.
When you started working at home, did the meaning of your desk change? You know, like when you're working in an office, your desk has things that a desk doesn't necessarily need because it's like your station away from home. So you might have like a can opener in it in the way that you wouldn't have a can opener in your study in your home. Right. You might have a picture of your spouse or lover on the desk in the office, but if you're working at a home where your spouse or lover lives, you don't really and there aren't other employees around, you don't really need that picture on the desk.
Right.
So
right.
Did your desk become equipped completely differently?
My desk became such that no other human being should really be forced to look at it because it's so overburdened with crap. And I'm a terrible pack rat, and it's messy, and I would probably be institutionalized if I brought that into a place of, like, commercial business. So I had a lot of stuff on there. But, you know, this, in some sense, it was important for me to take the perception that that anybody that works in a cubicle are kind of like they're drones, and put that on its head a little bit, because I think that when we go into an office, we're so scared of becoming drones that something primal is kick-started and we do everything in our power to become individuals. That's why we bring the stuff into our offices, you know, the weird posters and the doodads and the snow globes and the knickknacks that sort of define you and make you who you are, in a great effort to kind of break out of that perception that you're just another one of many.
You know, one of the things about having a job is that when you have problems, you can always blame the job. You know, the job can be the source of your unhappiness.
Yeah.
The job can be the source of why you have no time. The job can be the reason why, you know, fill in the blank. And when you don't have like a salaried position, the kind of position where you report for work, and you're working at home writing books, which is what you do now, can you externalize your problems and blame them on something in the same convenient way that you can when you're doing an actual job? You know?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
if it wasn't for this darned book, blah, blah, blah.
You bet. Mm-hmm. My UPS man, mm-hmm. my cat.
What did your UPS man cause in your life?
Oh, actually,
nothing. What can you pin on him?
I absolutely love Joe. Joe comes to the door and he's got a packet, and I try to convince him in to have coffee with him because I'm bored and I don't want to write. And, you know, he looks at his watch. I got a lot of deliveries to make today still, man, so I think I'm going to have to pass. He's actually a great break in the day for me now. But if I need to blame him, I'm happy to. I'm happy to blame my cat that jumps on the printer and starts the copy machine rolling. I'm happy to blame anything other than myself and my lack of ability as I continue to write.
Well, Joshua Ferris, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Joshua Ferris is the author of the new novel, Then We Came to the End. You can catch interviews that you missed by downloading podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.